This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For over a half a century, Bob Woodward has been gaining access to and reporting on people in the highest positions of power in the United States. And when it comes to presidents, he has gone toe-to-toe with nearly everyone since Richard Nixon.
And if you look at Nixon, sorry, he failed.
Right.
Why?
Because of you.
No. That's not the... I mean, there's
you
more...
Helped.
Woodward is every inch the reporter, not at all someone inclined to editorialize. But in his many hours of conversation with Donald Trump, from before the election in 2016 through the initial fallout of the COVID crisis, Woodward came to see Trump as not just a disruptor, but a real danger to the nation. He's now released the audio recordings of some of those conversations in a new book called The Trump Tapes. We hear Donald Trump's state of mind in his own peculiar words, but we also gain a greater appreciation for Woodward's process and his craft. Bob, you are now out with something very unusual. You've been publishing books, obviously, since Watergate about the American presidency. Now you're publishing, with The Trump Tapes, an edited version of your raw materials, your tapes with Donald Trump. And I have to ask you, after your first book about Trump in 2018, which was hardly a flattering portrait, why do you think he went on talking to you incessantly?
Well, this goes into the state of his mind. It is a confidence that he can sell himself to anybody. I'm sure you remember this about George Kennan, the famous father of the containment theory and practice of containing the Soviet Union. And Kennan had this phrase, the treacherous curtain of deference, that you go into the Oval Office and people just melt. And you have Trump's dominant personality with this treacherous deference that takes place, and he thought he was in control.
But okay, but you were not intimidated by
the Oval Office.
Why would you be?
You can't be. It was, again, one of these things Trump just decided he's going to do. Lindsey Graham told him, he won't put words in your mouth. And I don't put words in his mouth. So there I am in the Oval Office before the Resolute desk. He has his props, pictures of he and Kim Jong-un. And we start talking about 2016, why he won. And this is something historians are going to be exploring for 100 years. And my analysis was, it's Barbara Tuchman's notion of the dying of the old order, that the old order was dying in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And Trump got that intuitively, not intellectually, and he just jumped in his chair when I said yes, and I'm going to do it again. Of course, he did not.
You know, but I remember watching you early on television one morning. And I was a big loudmouth about Trump from the start. And maybe it's because I'm here in New York and years of listening and watching Trump. And I've been wrong about things in the past, but I thought this guy was pernicious and worse right from the start. And I was watching you on Fox, and it was true that you were saying, and many people were not, that he should be taken seriously and that he might win. But I didn't hear you being hypercritical of him like many in the media were back then. And I thought to myself, God, Woodward is really smart, because Woodward wants to get to this story.
No.
Were you playing him?
No, of course not.
Okay.
Look, if you've listened to these tapes, I was combative with him all the time and say, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing? But I really, it's the Graham Greene line about don't despise your enemies. They have a case, and you need to understand the case. And in the case of Trump or anyone, it's who are they? And you want to come reasonably with a blank slate. Okay, I'm here to listen.
I've always thought of Trump in many ways as the most transparent president of our lifetime, that what you see on television is not dissimilar from what you get in private. By talking to him privately, and you had endless conversations with him in person, on the phone, by surprise, and on and on and on, what did you learn in private that you were not getting in public?
That's an important question. In this process, which was strange, I could call him anytime. He would call me. Elsa, my wife, and I, she used to joke, there are three of us in the marriage, and the phone would ring, and is it one of our daughters? Is it a friend? Is it a robocall? Or is it Donald Trump? And it would often be Donald Trump. Here's the variable. I could ask follow-up questions. It wasn't a press conference or a stop at the helicopter on the White House lawn, which all presidents, Trump indeed included, control the environment. And no one can say, hey, oh, wait a minute, you didn't answer the question. So I would have sessions with him, like after the first impeachment. I literally was the interrogator. Why did you do this? How can you do this? Look at that. Or most importantly for me, the experts like Dr. Fauci telling me this, Trump's not listening about the virus. Well, what's he not listening to? These are the 15 things he needs to do that they could not talk to him about because he would not pay attention.
There are times in the interviews where you tell Trump what to do. Talk to Bill Gates about the pandemic response, or go ask Ivanka if he should apologize for the call to the Ukrainian leadership that led to the first impeachment. Maybe talk about those moments. And before you do, let's play one or two.
Who's the person you trust most in the world?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I don't want to get into it because I have so many people. I have great family members. I trust my family members.
Ask them if you should apologize.
I think if I apologized for something that I did nothing wrong.
It's a question of...
How can I apologize for making a decent statement, a very, very appropriate statement?
You got another one here about Bill Gates. Let's hear that.
There are all kinds of wise people out there. Have you been able to talk to Bill Gates?
He called me a little while ago. What do you think of Bill Gates?
You know, I do not know him. I just know he spent billions of dollars on fighting these diseases, and he's very informed.
He also gets a lot of money from the U.S. government to fight.
Yes, he does, but he puts up a lot of his own money, too. And you know about when somebody puts up money, it means they care. Somebody like that you need to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, okay, I'll weigh that. I will talk to all the business people. I'll talk to the Faucis. I'll talk to the experts. And then out comes the, you never make a perfect decision.
Right.
But out comes the best decision.
I have to ask right away, Bob, the notion that you are talking to a guy in his 70s who's the president of the United States and you're telling him about the rudiments of how you make a decision, you talk to a lot of experts and come to conclusions. I mean, were you thinking to yourself, I'm talking to an idiot?
If I may, look, I think what he did as president is worse than criminal. And I think it's provable on many levels in many ways. But I think it's a mistake to call him or think of him as an idiot because he navigated something, what 46 people have in the history of this country.
He won
got
the presidency.
To the presidency. You want to criticize that, certainly, and examine it. But I think in 2016, in my business, and I put myself at the top of the list, we were not inquisitive enough about Trump because we loved the show and the pyrotechnics.
I think the foreign policy issue that's concentrated upon the most here and is the perhaps the most revealing is North Korea and his relationship with Kim Jong-un. Here he is joking with Kim Jong-un about the Little Rocket nickname. Let's listen.
We've always gotten along great. I said, did you ever hear of the song Rocket Man? He said, no, no. Did you ever hear of Elton John? No, no. I said, I did you a great favor. I called you Rocket Man. He goes, you called me Little Rocket Man. You know, he looks at me.
He knew.
Oh, he knew that. Yeah, he didn't like Little Rocket Man. Rocket Man was okay, but he didn't like it.
But just to go back with
now, is this someone taking the presidency seriously?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, they're joke moments, but this was not a joking issue. And if we play some of the other tapes of Trump telling me about that relationship, it might be useful.
Is this all designed to drive Kim to the negotiating table?
No, it was designed for whatever reason. It was designed, who knows, instinctively. Let's talk instinct, okay? Because it's really about, you don't know what's going to happen. But it was very rough rhetoric. The roughest.
Again, part of the tragedy. Who knows? Who knows? You know, why are you doing this? What's your purpose? What's the strategy? What's the plan? Who knows? It's instinct.
But the CIA says about Kim Jong-un, you know, they do all this analysis and reporting that he's cunning, crafty, but ultimately stupid.
I disagree.
But, you know, I'm sure they tell you that.
I hope you write that, and I hope you write my answer. I disagree. He's cunning, he's crafty, and he's very smart. And he's very tough, you know.
Why does the CIA say that?
Because they don't know, okay? Because they don't know. They have no idea. I'm the only one that knows. I'm the only one he deals with. He won't deal with anybody else.
What do you make of that?
I make of this is the danger of Trump. Only I know. I'm the only one who knows. I've written books and reporting in the Washington Post about 10 presidents. I've never heard of one say or imply to anyone that they're the only one that knows. In fact, it's maybe some of them at times have thought that, but they realize, again, you need to open the door to other information, thoughts, and conclusions. You and I both worked at the Washington Post when Ben Bradley mm-hmm. was the editor. Ben, can you imagine Ben running around? Only I know. I mean, he would come and call you into his office. What do you know? What's going on? Pull up a chair literally next to your computer.
He's very hungry for information.
Why? Because he knew that was the path, as he used to always say, the truth emerges slowly, sometimes
fitfully.
Slowly.
What do you think?
You were really shouting at him.
I was.
to get in the word edgewise.
You're shouting, though. It's really loud.
It's okay. It's okay.
You want to get more
I know.
Information from him. Not
like this, I agree.
Not telling him what he needs to do. You kind of sounded like you were telling him what to do.
Yeah, well, same. I kept. Okay, but we're in a different world now, sweetie.
So if for those who couldn't quite make that out, you're saying that you're in a different world now with a guy like Trump, while Elsa Walsh, your wife and herself, an extremely good reporter, is telling you that you were shouting at him and that I can't imagine, that's not your temperament so far as I know.
No, that's right. But this was an interview April 5th. I had talked to Fauci and all the experts, and they told me, as I was saying, that, you know, he won't listen. Well, what won't he listen to? And I had 15 things, and I literally went through them with Trump. You need to coordinate internationally. Henry Kissinger just written an op-ed piece about that. Of course, Trump didn't. Oh, what'd Kissinger say?
You were talking to the President of the United States, in real time, constantly during this crisis, this extended crisis. And I wonder, obviously you nailed down the date when he knew about this and the seriousness of it, but how would you characterize the person you were talking with, his level of curiosity, engagement, seriousness? I mean, how would you characterize those conversations overall?
What he's serious about is himself. Again, to go to July of 2020, this is a point, the virus had killed 140,000 people in this country. And talking to Trump on the phone, recording it, all of these are recorded mm-hmm. with his permission. I said, it's pretty bad. And he said, what are you talking about? What's bad? And I said, well, the virus. He said, oh, we've got it under control. Under control. I mean, I'm almost jumping through the phone. It's nothing under control. And he said, I mean, this is, listen to it. Hear him in his own, well, I'll have a plan in 104 days. And he said, well, if I put it out now, what no one will remember. And then I did the calculation, 104 days was election day. He's thinking about the election.
Bob, you've been at this for over 50 years, this activity of reporting, and you've certainly reached the age of self-reflection. I wonder if you can boil it down, what you think that have been your central achievements, and what did you miss or get wrong?
Well, I got a lot of things wrong. What Carl Bernstein and I tried to do in a piece we wrote for The Post, which is the new introduction to All the President's Men, is draw the connection between Nixon and Trump. And they are so many. It is really alarming. And what was Watergate? It was an effort to destroy the process of nominating and electing a president. What is it that Trump has done? It is, in the same way, destructive of the process of January 6th, which is in the Constitution and in the Electoral Act laid out in great detail. This is how we decide who is president. The vice president, who's the president of the Senate, convenes the House and the Senate, and they count the electoral votes. And here was an equivalent realization by Trump and others that this is the soft spot. You know, if somehow we can get Pence to not count the votes or adjourn the meeting, just like Nixon, if he can just destroy the process the Democrat opposition party had in 1972 to nominate a strong candidate. I mean, it's devastating what Nixon did to destroy that process, and it is devastating what Trump did trying to destroy that process on January 6th.
Finally, Bob, I want to ask an institutional question. The Washington Post, I think at this moment, after some really strong years, is struggling. It's losing subscribers by the hundreds of thousands. It's hemorrhaging talent. Its business leader, Fred Ryan, has failed to do for the Post what the leadership of the Times has done, and he also seems not to like journalism very much. The editor, Sally Busby, is confiding to reporters that she might be headed for the exits after just a year in place. You care about the Post a lot, and you probably remain, you definitely remain its most vivid figure. If you could tell Jeff Bezos anything about what to do about the Washington Post at the current moment, what would you say?
Oh, boy. I've known Bezos for more than 20 years, and I communicate with him, and it's clear to me he's aware that there's trouble, and I think I know he's in a listening mode about what people think, what those troubles are, where they come from, I know him well enough. He's not an impulsive person, but can be very thorough. There is an awareness that he has and other levels in and outside the Post that that some repair work needs to be done. What that is and how and who is responsible. I'm on the sidelines. I'm in the old geezer class. And there's nothing worse than the people who've been there before coming along kind of saying, oh, well, when I was there, it was different. So I am confident that, and again, this is an interesting comparison to Trump. There are on these tapes discussions of Trump about Bezos, because Trump's telling me, oh, Bezos directs what you do. And I said, no. And he keeps hands off. Oh, he said, I don't believe that. And made it clear if he owned the Washington Post, he would have his hands around the throats of everyone to do what he wants.
Just to be clear, you're talking to Bezos?
I'm just not going to say who I've talked to or how I do it. It's just like the reporting. There are no Bezos tapes.
Bob Woodward, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bob Woodward's new book, it's his 22nd, is called The Trump Tapes. The audiobook is available now, and the book is out in paperback this month.
Mr. Woodward, the president.
Hi, Bob.
President Hi. Trump, how are you?
How are you? Lindsay said give you a call. I just spoke to a couple of people. I said, I just came back from two speeches, and I said, I got to call the man. What's going on? You doing okay?
I am. I was watching.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to NetSuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Louisa Thomas covers sports for The New Yorker, everything from the World Cup and the Olympics to the NFL and tennis and the Brittany Griner saga, even the World Chess Championship. We got together last week to talk about the year ahead in sports, but just the night before we spoke, Damar Hamlin of the Buffalo Bills suffered cardiac arrest after a tackle, and football fans all over America watched in horror. Louisa, you have an unusually intimate view of pro football, far more than most sports writers. Your husband was an offensive lineman for the Baltimore Ravens, John Urschel. He's also a mathematician, and he left the game some years back. He decided he'd had enough. What do you make of what happened to Damar Hamlin, to say nothing of the countless head injuries that we've seen and pro football's seeming inability to guard itself and its players against the innate violence of the game?
I mean, you said it yourself. It is innate in the game. It's intrinsic. Violence is part of football. It's part of why it's so exciting, to be honest. It's part of why people are so drawn to it, because there are real stakes in those violent clashes. You know, when someone that you love, when a family member is on the field, yeah, football can feel different. I mean, you end a game and you take note of the score, but you also take note of whether anyone was injured and seriously injured.
You once told me that to play a football game is to be in a car accident every single time.
Yeah. I do remember one day when John came back from a game and we were talking and suddenly he remembered his like shoulder hurt, you know, and he'd separated joint. I mean, it was sort of this kind of like an afterthought. It was an afterthought because, you know, players are just in pain after games. And they're also just like so high in adrenaline. But the point is they're injured all the time. And they deal with pain that we can't even imagine. And they deal with risks that we can barely imagine.
Is it a fantasy on the part of, you know, high-minded fans in the league to think that somehow you're going to make this game a hell of a lot safer than it is?
Well, the game as we know it is a response to the incredible brutality of football. You know, at the turn of the 20th century, players died all the time. Teddy Roosevelt summoned the various members of the Harvard and Yale and everyone to discuss, you know, what could be done about football, because players were literally dying on the field. And that led to, for one, the invention of the forward pass. So it's not true to say that we can't do anything. Something has been done before, but it's hard to imagine that kind of radical change would take place. I mean,
so
because
the pass was a way to avoid injury.
To avoid
and now
death.
You see people coming across the middle to get a pass, taking their life in their own hands.
Yeah. So the thing that we always come back to is that what makes the game so exciting, the reason that football games are the most watched event in America, you know, year after year after year, is that they are live, they are dangerous, they are exciting, they are thrilling, and they are violent. And we do ourselves a disservice to ignore that fact, because that's what they are. And, you know, it's the reality that that's what people are drawn to. And players know what they're risking. I mean, I don't think we should infantilize them to say that, you know, they don't really know what they're doing. They know, but yeah, it's scary. I'm a little bit unnerved by this experience, just like everyone else.
DeMar Hamlin's injury was a terrifying start to the year in sports. But I also want to know what else you're anticipating in 2023. We did just experience an astonishing World Cup, and soccer seemed maybe briefly to steal the show, even in this country. Do you see soccer, the other football, having a real impact on American life and maybe even cutting in on the NFL's popularity at some point?
Oh, I think this is all, we're talking about relative degrees here. I think soccer is absolutely going to become much bigger in the United States. I really do think that. I also think that football, and particularly the NFL, is so big. We're talking magnitudes greater interest. There is so much attention that the NFL can lose a lot of fans. A lot of people can turn off their TV, and it will still be the biggest thing in the United States.
The U.S. women's national soccer team had a very public fight for equal pay. We also saw players speaking out about Black Lives Matter. Do you see that trend continuing with the newer players that are coming up in women's soccer?
Yeah, I think they grow up with the expectation that this is part of the job, honestly, and they are not afraid. I think that the challenge will be whether or not they take it a bit for granted. They have achieved what they set out to do. The remarkable thing is that they have equal pay. You know, does that mean that their job is, you know, quote unquote, done? I think that the ones who are inclined, you know, players like Midge Purse, I think are natural leaders in social justice issues, and they will, you know, continue to use their platform to speak out on issues that they care about.
Finally, the most important issue for 2023, is LeBron James headed back to Cleveland yet again?
You know what? The amazing thing about the NBA is that I don't think about LeBron James that much anymore. Don't tell him. The league doesn't quite revolve around him
anymore.
Yeah. I mean, good on him. You know, he's 38 years old and still, you know, one of the best players in the NBA / history, even at his current level.
I got to say, there's a player, Luka Doncic, and this guy, you look at him, and the way he's playing, he's kind of like a slightly out of shape uncle figure. He looks like he's playing basketball in flip-flops. You know? And the other night, he had a game where he scored 60 points, 21 rebounds, 10 assists, and the statistics didn't even seem to tell the story. He was so dominant.
He actually forced overtime by intentionally missing a free throw, and he scored this kind of improbable shot, and then he did this like little shimmy shake dance. It was too much. It was amazing. I mean, that guy is just fun to watch. He reminds me kind of like a puppy dog. Like he just makes you smile.
The player that excites me most to go see, I was lucky enough to go see the Knicks play the Memphis Grizzlies.
I knew you were going to say him because he's the player who excites me the most too.
Oh, Ja Morant is insanely good. Insanely good. And it makes me feel like I wish I were pulling in every Memphis Grizzly game.
He's fearless. I mean, I think that a compilation of his misses might be more exciting of his compilation of his made dunks. I mean, this guy just wants to jump over 7 feet men. Like, it's just his thing. And he is not afraid. He's tiny. I mean, you know, not by, you know, human standards, but by NBA basketball standards. He's really small, and he can just pogo over, you know, centers like it's nothing.
But sadly, the dominant team, and it kills me to say it, is the Boston Celtics.
And that was not, you know, people didn't really know what to expect. You know, they had a kind of very rocky offseason. They came out of the, you know, the NBA finals looking kind of young and fresh, but people really didn't know what to expect, and they just burst out of the blocks. I mean, they just... with the best offense in the NBA. And you know, they're sort of settling down, but they have on any given night Jason Tatum, they have, you know, the guy who's probably the best player on the floor, and they seem to be very well coached. And yeah, they're an incredibly exciting team.
Louisa Thomas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read Louisa Thomas on sports at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 46 years ago, a young photographer named Marilyn Nance got the opportunity of a lifetime. Nance was a 23-year-old student at the Pratt Institute, an art school in Brooklyn, and she had never left the country. But she became one of the official photographers to document a festival called Festac 77, which was held in Lagos, Nigeria. Festac was huge, an arts and culture festival featuring artists from across Africa and the diaspora. Nance spent a month soaking up the atmosphere and preserving its spirit in photographs that are only now being published in a book called Last Day in Lagos. Marilyn Nance talked with our staff writer Julian Lucas about her experience and why so many of us have never heard of Festac 77.
Festac 77 was, it was like Woodstock. It was like a biennial. There were art exhibitions. It was like the Olympics because we all marched around a stadium in our national dress. It was a meeting of African folks from all over the world.
All our roots and our part in Black culture and African culture was incredible. And I looked around at this sea of Black faces, and I had never seen a collection of Black people larger than New York, larger than America, and this was the largest collection of Black people I had ever seen in my life. And I felt the earth move. I felt that there was a place here for us, and we are not Nigerian, we are not African, but we are an African people.
This is the motherland, and it's taken me all...
You were involved in the Black arts movement from a young age, and I wonder if you had a sense of the significance of this festival before you went.
I did, but I never thought that I would get to be like this age, and I thought that I would be talking about Festac in 1978 and not in 2022. You know, I did not know then that it would be disappeared from history. I thought it was something that was so big to me and to all the other participants that surely this would be something that would resonate for years and years to come. And I think that if someone had gotten, if there's some tragic something that happened, everybody would remember, but it was a joyful thing. And I guess maybe there was no investment in celebrating Black joy.
Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You are welcome to Nigeria, where the Festac is taking place. Here in Nigeria, in Africa. Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
It's really extraordinary how much it's been forgotten when you see your photographs and you see Stevie Wonder, Miriam Makeba, Sun Ra in this wonderful procession of nations.
But I've been witness to a lot of extraordinary events, and it points to the fact that a lot doesn't get said. And I knew that. I knew that even as a youngster. I knew the way that our lives were regarded, and I knew differently. And I think that's why I set upon becoming a photographer, because there are things that I saw that I just wanted other people to witness as well. But making the photographs is one thing. Getting them seen is quite another thing.
Mm.
They want the oil, but they don't want the people. They want the oil, but they don't want the people. They want the oil, but they don't want the people. They want the oil, but they don't want the people. They want the oil, but they don't want the people. They want the oil, but they don't want the people.
I wanted to ask you about a great photo you took of Queen Mother Moore.
I love that picture.
And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about her and why it was so significant that she was there at the festival.
At the making of that photograph, Queen Mother Moore was greeting, you know, making some exclamation, which I wish I remembered, but I have the photograph. I don't know what she said, but...
It's a really regal photograph of her. And what I loved after reading about her was, this is someone who had been an activist since the Scottsboro Boys, who had been part of Marcus Garvey's movement, which of course was so centered around returning to Africa. And then decades later, here she is in a very different cultural, political moment.
Well, I wouldn't say different. I would say it's a continuum. She talked about reclaiming your African personhood. She talked about reparations, and she was the connecting thread. There were numbers of distinguished elders. That was her position. And Joseph Delaney, who was there who was part of the Harlem Renaissance. There was Ernest Critchlow, Nadi Kumar, elder musicians, young people. There was a whole continuum of the Black creative spectrum, you know, in the visual arts, the spoken word. Jane Cortez was there, Melvin Edwards. I mean, just...
Since you're mentioning all these artists and performers, I remember reading that at one night in the Festac Village where the delegates were staying, Stevie Wonder came hung out with the delegation. What do you remember about that?
Well, I don't even remember how we knew that he was there, but there he was. It was almost like a campfire situation, except for there was no fire. I don't remember what he said, but we were just like, oh, Stevie Wonder, you know.
Music is a world within itself, with a language we all understand.
All of the action was in Festac Village because all of the delegations, all of the contingents were there, and there was music. I mean, I would lay down and, like, I'm exhausted, but then you'd hear drums over here and music over there. You could not rest. In Festac Village, and maybe Stevie heard about that, showed up with Samela Lewis and Louis Farrakhan and Jeff Donaldson.
East or West, Africa is my home.
It's not like I have a fantastic memory, but I do have photographs, and that's how I remember. I astound people with my, air quotes, memory. But I see these images a lot.
There was Mozambique, uniformed in military outfits, reflecting their difficult armed struggle for independence. The sneakers they wore lightened their feet as they did traditional dances. From Europe came the Afro-Swedish and the Afro-Irish. Several hundred blacks from the United States participated. For the most part...
I wonder if you could take us to the Parade of Nations, the opening ceremony. Some of the kind of most immediately spectacular photos in your book are from that. Mm-hmm. You know, 54 countries. You have Malian kora players, traditional masquerade performers,
and it wasn't
singing
in a
groups.
Book. I mean, like we've only seen those images in books, but there we are, and they're real people. And they're looking at us like we've only seen these people like in movies or in books. We were just all staring at each other like, we're here.
An element of culture shock, I'm sure.
Yeah, and it wasn't like I was looking at the Parade of Nations. I was part of that Parade of Nations. We were just amazed at each other.
Africa, continent of future.
And I know it wasn't just a Black cultural festival. It was Black and African. Could you explain that?
Algeria was represented, Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia. These are countries on the continent of Africa that may not have claimed Blackness, but they're African. And then there were people from the diaspora who claimed Blackness, including, I was really surprised to see the Australian contingent, because we had been educated to believe that Australians were Asian, or I don't know what we were told, but here they were, dark-skinned people at a Black and African festival. And I was like,
On stage in the Nigerian National Theater, Sun Ra and his orchestra.
There's a great picture of Sun Ra's rehearsal shed in the book, with people just climbing on ladders, crawling to look underneath the wall, standing on tires. To me, that really gets at what the festival was about and what your method of photography is about. There's not really a boundary between the spectator and the action. You're part of it all.
I was one of those people. Like, I don't think I got on any ladders or anything, but I got down low to make some photographs. People crowded around the rehearsal sheds just to see, you know, what folks were doing. That one image points to maybe three or four rolls of film of that one rehearsal. It was amazing just to see, like, acrobatic troops.
The Flying Souls.
The Flying Souls. But there was a troop, and I'm not sure what country they were from, where this man was doing things with his body and bending, and like, I'm looking underneath and finding a space, and and no one made space for me because I had a camera. I had to find a space like everyone else had to find a space.
I wonder if you could say something about how this book came together. How did Last Day in Lagos get made 45 years after you flew back?
Well, first of all, Last Day in Lagos kind of came out of my knowing that I had work that I wanted to share with a younger audience. There was a group called the Brooklyn Photo Salon, young photographers in Brooklyn. I was like, Brooklyn Photo Salon, young people doing, let me see what's going on. So I started going to some of the meetings and introducing my work. I did a lot of networking, a lot of talking and going places. I wasn't like sitting waiting to be discovered. but it was in Johannesburg. I was presenting the Festac photographs at the Black Portraitures Conference in 2016. And I was there with my husband, Al Santana, my archive fellow, Valerie Caesar, and the artist, Valerie Maynard. We did the panel on Festac, and there was a panel of young people, and Olorimi Onabanjo was on the panel.
This is your editor.
Right, my editor. And I introduced myself to her after the panel was over, and I said something about Festac, and she was like, of course I know what Festac is, I'm Nigerian. Anyway, when she looked at the work, she said, like, I want to do a book.
She recognized its importance.
Right away. And my joke to her was like, Remy, I'm going to let you discover me.
You are still taking. It's true. I mean, where would the whole Western world be without Africa? Our cocoa, our timber, our gold, our diamonds, our platinum, our whatever, everything you are is us. I am not saying it, it's a fact. And in return for all...
Well, there's something kind of elegiac about your title, Last Day in Lagos, because this was the last festival of its kind, mm-hmm. a high point of this Pan-African spirit that wasn't repeated.
Yeah,
It's been 45 years, as you mentioned, since Festac. And I wonder if you could say something about what happened. Why didn't these photos come out?
That's not my business. I did what I did. Ask them, right? Whoever them is. You know, ask the historians, ask the publishers, ask, you know, all those people who ignored the work. I mean, I did the work. I didn't hide it.
Did you try to have them published when you came back?
Yeah.
What happened? How did people respond?
I can't tell you how they responded, but I had to go on living. So I started working in advertising. I've taught school. I've worked as a teaching artist. I pretty much know my worth. I know the worth of this culture. I know the value of this event. Even if you don't know it, I know it. And I just had to wait until, like, a new generation came. I think things happen and roll out when they're going to happen. And maybe this is the right time for this.
Well, I think that's a great place to end.
Yeah. You have a good radio voice.
Thank you.
Yeah, you think...
You have a great radio voice, though.
No,
make me sound good, too.
Marilyn Nance's photos of Festac 77 appear in Last Day in Lagos, which came out recently. And Julian Lucas is a staff writer covering culture of all kinds for The New Yorker. The music and clips we heard are from a Festac 77 mixtape compiled by Chimurenga in 2020 and reproduced courtesy of Chimurenga. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Rita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline, Mike Kutchman, and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.